serious consideration to throw a monkey wrench such as this could prove to be into their machinery. It seems to me, whether badly managed or well managed, that it is at least a setup which should be preserved and fought for. If that means serious and in some cases seemingly cruel sacrifices, it is, as we say, just too bad. But after all, if by any process whatsoever, this or any other, Russia is seriously crippled or destroyed, what good would freeing those prisoners do? Yet unlike Sartre or Dreiser or virtually all of the 400 leading Americans, Vice President Wallace had visited the Soviet Union personally. And not only did he visit, he toured the Siberian Gulag town of Magadan himself. Over 40 million people have taken the place of the 7 million, mostly convicts, who miserably existed there under Imperial Russia, Wallace explained. He compared the Siberian growth in population to how America after the Civil War developed her Wild West, pushing triumphantly to the Pacific and creating what Los Angeles, San Francisco, Portland, Seattle, and Denver mean today. One might think that perhaps the climate and therefore livability in Los Angeles would in and of itself make the comparison to Siberian development a reach, but that was hardly the worst of it. Wallace credulously reported his Russian contact telling him that 12 years ago, the first settlers arrived and put up 8 prefabricated houses. Today, Magadan has 40,000 inhabitants and all are well housed. Wallace helpfully explained that urban growth in northern Siberia is a proof that the climate is not an insuperable obstacle to settlement in the Arctic, as if a bunch of adventurous families had all decided to pack up and try to make their claim in Siberia. He was just blown away by these plucky Russians. The remarkable fact is that this Siberian urban growth is taking place in advance of rail and motor road communications. Wallace was oblivious to the reality that virtually all of these trips to Siberia were both one-way and permanent. He made it a point to note that when it came to the NKVD, everyone treated them with great respect. I became very fond of their leader. While boasting about how relatively well the shovel operators were paid, if the figures he repeats were even credible, Wallace neglected to mention that the nearby Karlak camp was a source of slave labor for the coal mines. Huge number of deportees were not even accused of any crimes, but were sent there simply due to their ethnicity, a constant issue in the heavily multi-ethnic Soviet Union. The people of Siberia today are a hardy, vigorous race, Wallace explained, but not because they are whipped into submission. The only whip driving them is the necessity to master a vast new land. Yet as of 2020, farmers were still uncovering dozens of bodies of people who had been executed by the NKVD. Wallace mused very enthusiastically about the literal song and dance performance that the Russians performed for him, gushing that, "I don't think I've ever seen anything better put on by the talent of a single city." It was actually not, as he characterized it, a concert by a non-professional Red Army choir of servicemen stationed in the town, but one put on by prisoners. The conductor was a prisoner, the lead ballerina was a prisoner, and the choir was all prisoners. There were, in fact, almost no Red Army servicemen in Magadan. The captives had rehearsed all night and signed an oath to comport themselves as Soviet patriots. Two singers who had known English were shipped away, and when the vice president's show ended, the prisoner performers were loaded back into trucks and returned to the camp. Whatever the dramatic content of the show, the circumstances surrounding it can only be described as a farce. That the Soviets are definitely planning for a big increase of population in their eastern territory was for Wallace not a premonition of vast human suffering, but 20th century frontiersmanship, because Soviet Asia will see the rise of its own Pittsburghs, Clevelands, and Detroits. After all, there exists no other two countries more alike than the Soviet Union and the United States of America. He took time to both praise Marshal Stalin's wise leadership and to point out that Roosevelt instantly felt at home with Stalin. Wallace elsewhere asserted that the people of the United States should have been taught the truth about the Russian Revolution from the very start, though what said truth is and who was lying about the revolution he does not explain. There is nothing irreconcilable in our aims and purposes, Wallace concluded. Those who so proclaim are wittingly or unwittingly looking for war, and that, in my opinion, is criminal. How criticizing the Soviet system in general or, say, denouncing slave labor camps would be looking for war, Wallace chooses not to make clear, not to mention who he imagines would be waging war and whom. This claim of warmongering was a common tactic for the Henrys Wallace of the world. As Orwell himself pointed out, when Henry Wallace is asked by a newspaper interviewer why he issued falsified versions of his speeches to the press, he replies, "So you're one of those people who are clamoring for war with Russia?" Wallace was happy to accuse his political opponents of wanting war. Wars weren't the result of power-hungry political leaders, no, they were the result of inequality. War in our generation began in 1914 and has, in the main, continued in one form or another for more than 30 years, he asserted. When we dip deeply into the economic and scientific causes of these 30 years of terrible struggle, we find the outstanding factor to be the unequal growth of industrialization and the consequent unequal growth of population and political power among nations. The worst part, perhaps, was how Wallace breezily dismissed the millions of people starved by Stalin in Ukraine and elsewhere as merely a price to be paid for progress. Collective farming to Stalin was a method of making agriculture more productive, of getting the food surplus necessary to support urban workers. We in the United States may regard the methods employed as too costly in human terms, but there is no denying that it was a measure for integrating farm output with urban growth and a necessary measure of the industrialization plan, out of which came Karaganda and the other new gulag towns, was to succeed. Part of Wallace's tour included information about a gold mine he was not told that it had led to over 16,000 deaths in 1942 alone. In fact, few of the people Wallace encountered were what they appeared or claimed to be. Being a politician, and a politician with a great deal of knowledge about farming and agriculture, Wallace made it a point to chat with as many ordinary people as he could. The bureaucrats who were pretending that they worked at the pig farm were clueless about his questions regarding pig husbandry, but were saved by the quick work of the translators. Decades after Wallace's visit, the hidden history of the gulag system has become better understood. Technically speaking, its roots lay in the Tsar's Katorga series of prisons, which held so many of the old Bolsheviks before the revolution. That said, in 1916, there were fewer than 30,000 total prisoners, while the USSR's gulag routinely held 2 million at a time. Though the term gulag came about under Stalin, by 1921, Lenin was already running 84 various camps for potential enemies and those deemed to be unreliable elements. That number became an archipelago of over 30,000 camps under Stalin, and it was under his reign that the camps began to be used for slave labor, especially in areas universally understood to be inhospitable to human life. Since many of the imprisoned were highly educated and technically skilled, it is no surprise that every Soviet industry from farming to military design was supported by the forced labor of prisoners. The first gulag camp is widely regarded to be Solovetsky, for this was the first camp that had been established by the Cheka independently of the larger Soviet justice system. It was there in 1926 where the concept of using forced labor as a method of re-education first began to be implemented. A converted former monastery, Solovetsky was located on a series of islands northwest of the city of Archangel. Roughly the same latitude as Fairbanks, Alaska, temperatures average from 4.6 degrees Fahrenheit in January to 61.7 degrees Fahrenheit in July. In 1923, there were a few hundred prisoners there, mostly political foes, including former allies, of the Bolsheviks. By 1925, there were 6,000, including many of those who had fought in the Kronstadt Rebellion. That winter, a quarter of them would die due to the terrible conditions they were living under, including the high workload, poor food, and an epidemic of typhus, a disease spread by lice. It was at Solovetsky that the inhuman sadism we have come to associate with concentration camps reared its head. Gulag historian Anne Applebaum writes that Solovetsky guards had regularly left undressed prisoners in the old, unheated cathedral bell towers in the winter, their hands and feet tied behind their backs with a single piece of rope. They had also put prisoners to the bench, meaning they were forced to sit on poles for up to 18 hours without moving, sometimes with weights tied to their legs and their feet not touching the floor, a position guaranteed to leave them crippled. Sometimes prisoners would be made to go naked to the baths up to 2 kilometers away in freezing weather, or they were deliberately given rotten meat, or they were refused medical help. At other times, prisoners would be given pointless, unnecessary tasks to move huge quantities of snow from one place to another, for example, or to jump off bridges into rivers whenever a guard shouted, "Dolphin!" Political prisoners under the Tsar, including Bolsheviks, had enjoyed a certain surprisingly high standard of living, with access to books, writing instruments, a fair amount of food, and even decent clothing. At the early stage of what would become the Gulag system, the prisoners still had the idea that they had rights. Their misconception was swiftly corrected. When one prisoner complained that someone had taken his parcel from home, he was stripped and tied to a post in the summer woods, helpless, while swarms of mosquitoes bled him dry. Others were executed at random, sometimes en masse. An accusation of plotting rebellion was enough of a pretense to kill as many people as the guards desired, with little possibility or time for the captives to disprove the accusation. The arbitrary nature of the murders created an atmosphere of constant terror, as it was intended to. Solovetsky was just the beginning. It was in Siberia where the Gulag system grew and grew as the Bolsheviks increased their power over the Soviet citizenry. Rounding up convicts often took a fair amount of time. Many would at first be loaded into trucks, which on the outside were labeled bread or fruits. They would sit organized in the shape of a chevron, with one person spreading his legs so the next could sit between them, and so on with the next captive. In some cases, waiting in the severe cold caused permanent physical damage for the adults and death for the child captives. Even without such extremes, the train trip to the Far East was hardly idyllic. Lice and the diseases they carried were ubiquitous. The simple need to relieve oneself was used as a mechanism of control by some of the guards, or even a simple exercise in cruelty by others. All it took was one prisoner losing bowel control or getting sick to turn the atmosphere into the carriage even more unbearable. It often took a month for the trip from Moscow to the Siberian Gulag region of Kolyma, a month in which the prisoner was literally removed from his former life and basic human civilization. The traveling captives would often go days without any water, and when they were fortunate to receive their one full cup, they would have to choose between drinking it all at once or rationing it out throughout the day. Passengers sticking out their cups between the window bars to catch rainfall would be threatened with getting shot. Stops to discard the deceased were an inevitable occurrence. It goes without saying that many of the infants and children aboard the train cars never made it to the camps. Mothers often killed themselves, slitting their throats with glass, or sometimes grew mad in the conditions, forcing their infants to be taken care of by other women. Those who survived the train ride were still not done, for the Kolyma camps were only reachable by boat. Attempts were made to keep the nature and extent of the growing gulag system secret from the population at large and from foreign countries. The NKVD need for complete secrecy caused them to force their human cargo below deck when close to Japan. In at least one instance, a Russian ship hit a reef and the crew refused to ask for help lest the nature of their journey be exposed. There were, of course, no lifeboats for the prisoners, and though a few Japanese fishermen tried to assist, over 1,000 people died. The juvenile delinquents who so plagued the prison system were found here as well. They served a purpose in the sense of keeping the captive population in a state of huddled fear as they reveled in hurling abuse at the adults, such as by spitting on them or urinating on them. Actual criminals are part of the trip too, seizing control of the ship's plank. Literal murderers and the like, they far outnumbered the guards who themselves were often too afraid to intervene. They would have fun by tossing fish guts at the political captives who dared to stick out their heads, or by vomiting on those in the cargo when they got seasick. These conditions made it harder and harder for the prisoners to think of themselves as civilized human beings with rights of any kind. Indeed, the counter-revolutionaries sentenced for political purposes were legally and explicitly regarded as worse than mere murderers or rapists, who were at least still members of the people. As one political prisoner explained, the criminals, however, were always told, "You have broken the law and must pay the penalty for it, but you are not enemies of the people. The enemies of the people are the counter-revolutionaries, and they alone are responsible for everything that goes wrong in our country. They must be annihilated." Guards would be threatened or bribed by criminals to let men into the separate women's hold, gangs of whom had their way with the female captives one after another. One eyewitness described such a raid. "Several men attacked each woman at once. I could see the victims' white bodies twisting, their legs kicking forcefully, their hands clawing the men's faces. The women bit, cried, and wailed. The rapists smacked them back. When the rapists ran out of women, some of the bulkier men turned to the bedboards and hunted for young men. These adolescents were added to the carnage, lying still on their stomachs, bleeding and crying on the floor. The male captives, hundreds of them, sat there watching the whole thing. Any man who tried to assist would be crushed to death, as happened during another such raid. After the guards blasted the hold with water to end the raid, they went down and dragged out both the women who had been injured and those who had been killed. Much of the skepticism about conditions in the Soviet Union was based on the very rational premise that this sort of mistreatment made no sense, for a large number of the captives who finally reached the camps were useless in terms of labor due to the horrors that they had suffered en route. Horrors that in some cases could have been prevented by simply allowing them to have water, but that would have been extra work for the guards, who had little incentive to lift a finger to assist a group of people who had officially been declared to no longer be members of society or even the human race. Arriving at the camps, the captives were greeted by various signs, with one example being the claim that, "With just work, I will pay my debt to the fatherland," reminiscent of Auschwitz's notorious "Arbeit macht frei" sign. Signage reminded the prisoners that he who does not work does not eat, but he who did work often didn't eat much either. Being too weak to fulfill one's work quota was often taken as evidence of the alleged counter-revolutionary behavior that got a person sent to the camps to begin with. Here at last were the wreckers made flesh, continuing their intransigence against the People's Republic. There was an idea in Kremlin circles that the camps should become economically self-sustaining. A caste system was developed early on, with prisoners divided between heavy workers, who got the most food, light workers, and invalids, who received half the food rations of the strong group. The critique that capitalism leads to the rich getting richer was here implemented as the organizing principle, with the strong getting stronger while the weakest grew weaker simply due to caloric intake alone. It was by 1937, during the Great Terror, where the nature of the camps took a turn. Stalin now sent regional quotas to the NKVD, telling them how many people he expected to be arrested, with the numbers broken down by each given region. It then became their role to find that amount of men and women to arrest and send away. If Stalin said to find 10,000 criminals in, say, the Turkmen Soviet Socialist Republic, the secret police would arrest 10,000 people regardless of whether that many criminals existed there or not. Instead of merely being exploitative, with poor living conditions causing many to perish, the Gulag now became became a place where the deaths of prisoners was regarded not as an accident or a cost or an afterthought, but as an outright goal. Outdoor work in the camps was compulsory all year round, only pausing if the temperature reached 50 degrees below. Working inside was not much better. Coal miners had to deal with water dripping on them, causing severe short-term and long-term consequences. In 1937, Stalin had also decided that the prisoners were being coddled. Thereafter, it was forbidden for the prisoners to use fur to stay warm. They were forced to use wadding for protection and to walk in canvas shoes instead of felt boots, if they even had or were given shoes at all, which many did not. Siberian blizzards are so notorious in their ferocity that even Westerners know to fear them. All of this contributed to a near total extermination rate in some locations, with Soviet sources themselves reporting a death rate of 97 to 98% of the inmates. When one free citizen tried to warn camp administrators that people in the camps might die, the response from the camp representative was clear. What people? These are enemies of the people. Other officials were as blunt. We are not trying to bring down the mortality rate. Captives were forbidden to refer themselves as comrades, which was the standard greeting the rest of the egalitarian Soviet Union. And in a bizarre but logical twist, despite the increasing ubiquity of his image in the greater USSR at large, simply looking at Stalin's picture was also not allowed to them. Nevertheless, the captives were still often subject to workshops where the speakers blathered political ideology at them. One Polish Jew who got swept into the gulag recalled how a professional agitator with the mentality of a six-year-old child would address the prisoners on the nobility of putting all their effort into work. He would tell them that noble people are patriots, that all patriots love Soviet Russia, the best country in the world for the working man, that Soviet citizens are proud to belong to such a country, etc., etc., for 2 solid hours. All this to an audience whose very skins bore witness to the absurdity and hypocrisy of such statements. For hours and hours, the lecture went on, recalled another camp survivor, trying to prove that God did not exist, that he was nothing but some bourgeois invention. We should consider ourselves lucky to have found ourselves among the Soviets, the most perfect country in the world. Here in the camp, we should learn how to work and at last become decent people. In our camps, you were expected not only to be a slave laborer, but to sing and smile while you worked as well, another former prisoner told Applebaum. They didn't just want to oppress us, they wanted us to thank them for it. Prisoners often had to be beaten in order to get them to bathe in the freezing cold rooms that they would then have to stand around in naked afterward. In the Soviet Union, the average person frequently had difficulty getting enough to eat, and in the gulag, food was disgusting even by prison conditions, often watery soups with fish heads or a piece of fat floating inside. Some prisoners were forced to eat outdoors, where the soup invariably froze. Antipathy toward organized religion was central to the communist state, and there was great pressure to break the spirits of prisoners who relied on their faith. One group of female prisoners refused to wear numbered clothing due to the dictates of their religion, so the numbers were stamped directly onto their skin. For added humiliation, they were forced to attend camp roll calls in the nude. In 1930, another religious group regarded Soviet passports, money, and the like as symbols of the Antichrist and refused to have anything to do with it. They were shipped to an island in the White Sea and told they could have food only if they signed for it. When they repeatedly refused, they were simply left there to starve to death, which they naturally all did. Diseases of malnutrition like pellagra were common in the camps, worsened by the theft of food by everyone from guards down to those prisoners working to prepare the meals. Peeling potatoes is viewed as a punishment in the American military, but in the gulag, it was a highly coveted role that might have saved a given prisoner's life due to having access to nutrition. As with other prisons, cultural mores developed within the mini societies that each camp became, with unspoken rules being enforced with, in some cases, extreme brutality. If a prisoner stole clothes, tobacco, or almost anything else and was discovered, he could expect a beating from his fellow prisoners, recalled one survivor of the gulag. But the unwritten rule of the camp was that a prisoner caught stealing another's bread earned a death sentence. Specifically, the thief would be tossed into the air over and over until he was seriously injured, and then would be thrown out of the barracks by his fellow prisoners to die. The Kolyma Basin is a huge Arctic region named for the river that cuts through it, though most of the rivers in the area are icebound for 8 to 9 months per year. At one point, it held the distinction for recording the lowest temperature on Earth. There was a song in Russia about the climate. Kolyma, wonderful land. 12 months winter, the rest summer. For about 2 months in winter, there's no sunrise at all. The brutal cold forced inmates to get creative in order to stay alive, and one of humanity's earliest mechanisms for maintaining warm bodies was practiced between prisoners or between female prisoners and guards. As a result of this, pregnancy in the gulag was not an entirely uncommon phenomenon. Those children who managed to survive through to birth were fed by their mothers but housed separately from them, possibly for the best, given the conditions that prisoners lived under. After a year, the babies were permanently taken from their mothers and handed over to the secret police. You have broken the regulations, the women were told. Connections with men are not permitted. Therefore, the children are ours, not yours. They belong to the security organs, and we will bring them up. Estimates range as to whether it was 500,000 or 1 million such infants were seized over the years. Those infants still fared better than children who were imprisoned in the gulag themselves, where even being 7 years old was not enough to stave off beatings and humiliations, not to mention the omnipresent cold and hunger. Parentless boys and girls who were taken to associated children's homes had to deal with all the above, as well as sexual assaults both from older children and administrators. Those who grew up in the inhuman conditions of the gulag grew up to themselves become something inhuman, as recalled former prisoner Les Razgan. They feared nothing and no one. The guards and camp bosses were scared to enter the separate barracks where the juveniles lived. It was there that the vilest, most cynical, and cruel acts that took place in the camps occurred. If one of the prisoner's criminal leaders was gambling, lost everything, and had staked his life as well, the boys would kill him for